love with Danger Bookstore on her first ever visit, and whenever she climbed the wooden staircase, she usually felt a little of the packing tape around her soul unwind. But this time, she just felt the stabbing in her neck get worse as she reached the top floor with its unsafe railing and threadbare purple carpet. Ernesto sat in his usual chair, eating a microwaved TV dinner. He was in love with the invention of the microwave, both because it fit in with his love of instant gratification, the lineaments of gratified desire, and because you couldn't leave food near him for more than a few minutes before it grew spiky white mold. He wore a silk robe, emerald pajamas, and fuzzy slippers, with William Blake's poems perched on one knee. "What the hell?" Patricia said before Ernesto could greet her. "When were you going to tell me about this plan to send me to Portland?" She almost knocked over the bookcase of ideas too good to be true. "Please sit." Ernesto gestured at a clamshell armchair. Patricia tried to rebel for a moment, then gave up and sat.
"We do not wish to send you away, but we have spoken about it. You make it difficult for us to watch over you. People want to care about you, and you will not let them."
"I've been trying." She shuffled in her chair. This was the worst day. "I've tried and tried. Everybody gives me grief about aggrandizement, but I've tried so hard. I've been so careful."
"You are hearing the wrong thing."
Ernesto rose and stood close to her, so she could feel his unnatural warmth.
"People warn you about aggrandizement, and you keep hearing the opposite of what they are saying."
Nobody knew why Ernesto was the way he was, but there were rumors. Like he'd cast a huge spell that had backfired. Or there'd been an endangered species, a rhino or something, and all the surviving animals had poured their life essence into one massive creature, which swelled with the lost potential of future generations. Maybe this towering gestalt stomped across the countryside, and everything it touched rotted. Blood bubbled from its eyes, ears, and stumpy toes, and it gave off an overripe stench. The creature, the story went, threatened a town full of innocent people until Ernesto took on its burden of excess life. Ernesto was so old, he'd gone to school back when El Tisley Academy and the Maze were still two separate schools. "Everybody thinks Siberia was my fault," Patricia said, "because I was too proud or whatever, too reckless." In her mind, Patricia saw before and after images of Toby, first alive, then dead, like a gif from hell. "They think I'm still too arrogant now. I'm just trying to help."
"Listen harder,"
Ernesto said. Most of the time, the thick eyeliner made his eyes appear lively, unfocused. But now, he seemed to see into the grungiest corners of Patricia's psyche. Ernesto went back to his chaise, and Patricia was left trying to figure this out. It was one of those annoying tests, both a dirty trick and a healing exercise. She was pretty sure she'd been listening just fine. She was ready to throw foodstuffs again. "Fine," Patricia said after she decided she wasn't going to crack this tonight. "I will listen harder, and I will try to be less self-absorbed and more humble. I will let people in, if anybody even wants to be my friend after tonight."
"I spent 30 bitter years trying to find a way to leave this place,"
Ernesto said so quietly she had to lean perilously close. He gestured at the room full of books, with his eyes.
"Until at last, I accepted that this imprisonment was a price that I had chosen to pay. Now I enjoy my situation as much as I can. But you have not yet begun to experience the pain of being a witch.
the mistakes, all the regrets. The only thing that will make such power bearable is to remember how small you are." He went back to William Blake, and Patricia couldn't tell if this meant their conversation was over. "So does this mean I'm not going to Portland?"
"Listen harder,"
was all Ernesto said from behind the book.
"We do not want to send you away. Do not make us."
"Okay." Patricia still felt raw and desperate inside. She realized she ought to leave before Ernesto offered to make her a cocktail next door, because she didn't want to get falling upwards drunk right now. As soon as she got out of danger, she saw her phone was full of texts and voicemails. She called Kevin, who was worried, and she was like, "I'm fine, except I need a drink." Half an hour later, she leaned on Kevin's crushed velvet frock coat and pounded a Corona in the swampy back room of the art bar on 16th, with fresh graffiti on the wall and a DJ spinning classic hip-hop. Kevin was drinking Pimm's with a fat cucumber slice and not asking her what the scene at dinner had been about. He looked amazing in the bar's golden light, sideburns setting off the smooth planes of his face. "I'm fine," Patricia kept saying. "I'm sorry you had to see that. I'm fine. I sorted it out." But as her tongue greeted the lime wedge bobbing up to the lip of the bottle and tasted the pulp mixed with beer, she remembered how Kevin wouldn't even look her in the eye when everybody else was accusing her of being a toxic loner.
"We should talk about what this is, right? You and me. What we're doing."
She started to say, trying to make herself heard over the DJ without shouting,
"I feel like we tried too hard not to label our relationship, and that became a label in itself."
"I have something I have to tell you,"
Kevin said, his eyes bigger and sadder than usual.
"I'm ready to open up about my feelings. I feel..."
Patricia searched for the right words.
"I feel good about us. I care about you, a lot, and I am open to..."
"I met someone else,"
Kevin blurted.
"Her name is Mara. She's also a webcomics artist of some renown. She lives in the East Bay. We met only in the past fortnight, but this already shows signs of becoming serious. I wasn't even looking, but my caddy pinged me with 29 points of convergence between Mara and myself."
He gazed into his Pimm's.
"You and I never said we were exclusive, or even that we were dating."
Patricia chewed her thumb, a habit she'd quit years ago.
"I'm happy, happy for you. I'm happy for you."
"Patricia."
Kevin took both her hands.
"You are utterly mad, but delightful. I feel so overjoyed to have gotten to know you. But I have been a fool too many times already, and I tried, I really did, to talk to you about our relationship on 5 separate occasions, in the park when we were roller skating, and also at that pizza bar."
As Kevin listed these moments, she could see them with perfect clarity. All the missed cues and deflections, all the abortive moments of intimacy. All this time she had been thinking of him as the one with commitment issues. Somewhere along the line, she had become an asshole.
"Thank you for being honest with me," Patricia said.
She sat and finished her drink until it was just lime rind and bitter pulp. Patricia wound up in Dolores Park at midnight. The heat still felt as intense as direct sunlight, and her mouth was dry. She couldn't go home and face Dee Dee and Rachelene. For some reason, Patricia found herself calling her sister, Roberta, whom she hadn't talked to in months, although she'd had a couple conversations about Roberta with her parents.
"Hey, Bert.
Hi, Trish. How is everything going?
I'm okay. Patricia took a breath, which came out staccato. She stared at the playground rocket ship and the Victorian houses with their pregnant windows. I'm sort of okay. I just... Do you ever feel like you're just throwing away the people in your life? Like being so self-centered that people just fall away? Roberta laughed.
I have the opposite problem. I have a hard time disposing of the bodies. Ha ha. Trish, listen to me for once in your life. I know we never got along, and I was partway responsible for you running away from home. But one thing I know about you is you're a generous person. You're a big bleeding heart. People have fucked with you, including me. Especially me. So you have a lot of defense mechanisms. But you always put yourself on the line for other people. You don't push people away. You try to do everything for people, and then they don't get to do anything for you. Please don't let any idiots tell you otherwise, okay?
Patricia was bawling, even worse than before, right there in the park. She felt it pour down her face, and she was full of a sense that everything was broken and full of sweetness. She had never realized her sister thought that way about her.
If anybody tries to tell you that you're selfish, Roberta said, send them to me, and I'll snap their necks for you. Okay?
Okay, Patricia stammered. They talked a bit more about Roberta's musical theater disasters and her latest attempt to go straight edge, and then at last, Patricia felt ready to go home and face her roommates, who were on the couch, like always. They slid over, without comment, to let Patricia watch TV with them. Patricia had another one of her dreams about being lost in the woods, this time running with a pack of deer. A barbarian yell in her throat and the scent of tree sap in her nostrils. She ran with her elbows and her stomach and her knees until she couldn't breathe. Patricia stumbled and fell onto her hands, gasping, laughing. She looked up and there was that big bird-shaped tree again, with the mindful gaze coming through its branches. Patricia walked up and touched it with her palms against its ropey bark, feeling the power rising and churning inside of it. Touching that weird tree from her childhood fancies, Patricia felt as though she could heal an entire army with a single breath. Air rushed through the tree, like it was drawing breath to speak to her in its stentorian whoosh. Then she woke up. She'd overslept, in spite of her alarm. Patricia was fixing Reginald's sink, which had one of those glitchy new valves that were supposed to shut off the water after a couple minutes, and she found herself talking about her breakup with Kevin. I mean, I guess it's for the best, since it was never going to work, but it's a symptom of the larger problem that I never have time for anybody, and I keep isolating myself, and I'm basically doomed to wind up alone forever, right? She expected Reginald to offer some bromides about how she just needed to be herself, but instead he said, "Get a caddy." What? She nearly bonked her head on the sink. "Get a caddy. It will change your life. I'm not kidding. At all. You become totally connected to all the people in your life. Not like regular social networking either. It's uncanny. You will just run into people you know, in person, when you most need to see them. I could barely afford one on my fixed income, but it turned out to be the best investment I ever made. I always thought they were just for mission hipsters, Patricia said. Anyway, it sounds creepy. Seriously, no. It's not creepy, and it's so easy to use. It doesn't spy on you or tell you to stalk your friends. I've never felt like it was invading my privacy. It just makes serendipity happen more often. It's unobtrusive and doesn't give you a bunch of alerts, but you'll always know what's the one party you shouldn't miss. I was feeling isolated, even with your much-appreciated visits. And then I got this caddy, and I feel as though I'm back in my own life again. In spite of Reginald's insistence that the caddy wasn't at all creepy, his hard sell was in itself kind of creepy. He sounded like someone who had just joined a cult. Patricia vowed that she would never, ever buy a caddy. Ever. 2 days later, Patricia was in the caddy store near Union Square. It was narrow, with curving walls that drew you toward the counter at the back, like a stream curving around some rocks. The walls seemed to glow. Patricia picked up a caddy from the display on one wall, and the screen flared to life. There was a swirl of colors, and then it resolved into a wheel shape. The wheel had swirls coming out of its center, sort of like a Taoist symbol, and each of them got bigger at her touch. They included things like communication, orientation, self-expression, and introspection. She paid for the caddy with her ATM card and felt like a total wanker. Next, she would go get some giant square dark glasses and a medallion that changed color depending on how recently she got laid. God. Still, it was a fun toy. And at this point, she would try anything to make herself feel less claustrophobic and self-absorbed. Although there was something perverse about buying a device that offered a huge introspection wedge in the hope that it would make her more social. That night, Patricia sat in bed and played with her new caddy. It wasn't that different from a standard tablet, except for the guitar pick shape, and the way it insisted on asking demented questions to customize your experience. Like, would you rather lose your sense of smell or taste? When was the last time you were glad you stayed up late? There was a checkbox to disable the questions, but everybody said they made it work a million times better, and they tapered off after a day. And sure enough, after a few days, the caddy was steering her oh so gently toward happy accidents and little discoveries. There was that little egg-themed restaurant in Hayes Valley where everybody sat in egg chairs and ate egg dishes, from scotch eggs to Chinese-style egg tarts, and drank cocktails with egg yolks. The whole place was an allergy waiting to happen, but it was also warm and cozy, and there was a faint smell of butter and sugar in the air, making her feel like she was in her grandma's kitchen and 5 years old. The caddy helped Patricia to figure out which bus to take to avoid being late for work, and when one of her Mary Janes broke a strap, the caddy steered her to a hole-in-the-wall place that fixed it on the spot. Within a few days, Patricia had a low-level awareness of what a dozen or so people in her life were up to at any given moment, without feeling overwhelmed. She managed to grab lunch with a very apologetic tailor and make time for an ice cream conference with Dee Dee and Racheline. Then something weird happened. Right around the time Patricia had gotten used to the caddy and started thinking of it as an extension of her personality rather than an appliance, after about 5 days, in other words, she started running into Lawrence. A lot. At lunch, at dinner, at tea, on the bus, in the park. At first, it didn't seem like a big deal, since San Francisco was a tiny town. But after a couple days, it felt weird. She would see Lawrence, say hi and mumble a few awkward words, and then bail. And then the process would repeat, a couple hours later. She would think he was stalking her. Except that she was the least stalkable person ever. The third day, she tried shaking up her routine, going for vegan soul food in the outer sunset, and somehow Lawrence was there too, going to some kind of Musée Mécanique revival. Hey again, he said. He started to say something else, but seemed to think better of it. She was already saying, hey, and turning back to talk to Taylor. She wasn't trying to avoid Lawrence, exactly, but at the same time she wasn't dying to hang out with someone who had promised Kawashima that he would keep her from getting a swelled head. She already had enough people giving her shit for aggrandizement. She didn't need a friend who was sworn to tear her down. Of course, this had been Kawashima's plan all along. If he'd told Patricia she wasn't allowed to hang out with Lawrence anymore, she'd have been pissed and would have hung out with Lawrence anyway. So instead, Kawashima tells Patricia to hang out with Lawrence all she wants, then enlists Lawrence's aid in cutting her down to size, thus ensuring she'll never want to see him again. That she saw through this ploy didn't prevent it from working perfectly. On her break at work, she picked up her caddy and scrawled, "What's the deal with Lawrence?" with her finger. The caddy responded by telling her some facts about Lawrence, including some physics prize he'd won at MIT. She couldn't help feeling like the caddy understood perfectly well what she was asking and was just playing dumb. She decided to leave the caddy at home. And for a whole day, her life was boring again, just missing the bus and not connecting with her friends and not having time to grab dinner in the middle of running errands. The rain started as she was heading home for the night, and she had forgotten her umbrella, and there was no place to buy one. And of course, she had to run 10 blocks to catch the bus, which left just as she got there. She waited another half an hour, under a disintegrating canopy, for the next bus, and when she staggered on board, drenched as a sponge, the only empty seat was next to Lawrence. "Oh, shit," Lawrence said. "You are fucking soaked. Jesus, I'm so sorry. That is fucked up." He gave her his nice cotton hoodie to use as a towel. She tried to say it was cool and he didn't have to do that, but he kept shoving it at her. "Thanks." Patricia patted herself with the hoodie as best she could. At least the heat wave finally broke. "This bus doesn't go to your place, does it? I mean, you have to change buses," Lawrence said. Patricia admitted that this might be the case. "Well, I understand if you need to get home right away, but there's a bar up here on the right that has an actual open fireplace, and they serve hot toddies and stuff. We ought to get you warmed up as soon as possible." The bar had a hunting lodge theme, complete with slabs of wood covering the walls and faux animal heads coming out of one wall that squicked Patricia at first. But they got a primo spot in front of the fireplace, and the scent of mesquite and wood smoke was a rain antidote. The stereo played an album of acoustic covers of Steely Dan, featuring a bluesy female mezzo-soprano, and Patricia guessed it was called Steely Danielle. Lawrence brought Patricia a mug of hot chocolate and a shot of nice whiskey, which she could consume together or separately, her choice. She drank most of the hot chocolate and then sipped the whiskey to burn away the milky sweetness. The whiskey was sharp in the way that really nice cheese is sharp. She started to feel comfortable in her own skin again. "I suspect I'm being punished for leaving my caddy at home," Patricia confessed. This wasn't the first time Lawrence had heard people talk about their caddies as if they were jealous gods. He told her about all the odd superstitions, for lack of a better word, that people had about their teardrop-shaped computers. One person might believe his caddy saved his marriage, and then you'd run into someone else whose caddy destroyed her marriage. But she later decided it was for the best. People sold their houses and got rid of their cars because their caddies showed them a simpler way to live. A few people even found God, actual God, thanks to their caddies. People were attached to them in a way that nobody ever had been to their iPhones or Blackberries. "That's not creepy at all," said Patricia. She wondered if she should just throw it away. On the one hand, it's finally fulfilling the promise of technology, of making your life easier, Lawrence said. Simpler, or more full of excitement, depending on what you want. On the other hand, people are outsourcing some crucial life stuff to these things. "I notice you don't have a caddy." Patricia's whiskey glass was empty. She bought another round for herself and Lawrence. "I have 3 at home," Lawrence said. I jailbroke one, and now it doesn't work quite the same. There's something about the OS that resists any kind of analysis. You can install Wildberry Linux on them, and they work just like any other tablet, but nothing fancy. They fell into a long silence. The fire crackled, and the Steely Dan cover CD reached its triumphant final track, which was predictably, "Ricky, don't lose that number." Patricia felt like she should say something about why she'd been avoiding Lawrence, in spite of her caddy's attempts to smush them together. She wasn't sure what to say. "That promise," Lawrence said out of nowhere, "the one that your friend made me agree to. Not the first one, the one where I go mute forever if I blab, but the other one." "Yeah." Patricia tensed and felt a chill on the inside, in spite of the firelight and whiskey glow. "It's riddled with loopholes," Lawrence said, "even apart from the fact that there's no penalty for breaking it. I mean, I never should have agreed to it, and I wouldn't have if I'd been less drunk. It's not my job to police someone else's self-esteem, not in any sane world. But in any case, it's a meaningless promise."
"How so?"
"I've been thinking about it a lot, and the wording is so imprecise that it's not even a promise in any real sense. I'm supposed to keep you from getting an unrealistically high opinion of yourself. But if, say, I happen to believe that you're the coolest person I know, then I'm unlikely to think you're overestimating your own coolness. It's dependent on my own opinion, plus my estimation of what your opinion of yourself is. That's a whole bunch of subjective criteria right there. Add to that the fact that I only said I would do my best, which is yet another subjective judgment. If I made it my life's work to break that promise, I'm not sure I could find a way."
"Huh."
And now Patricia felt dumb. So Lawrence had succeeded in crushing her ego after all. She should have seen that Kawashima was just creating one of his intentionally flimsy traps, where the real trap is that you fool yourself into believing the snare to be robust. But she also felt better. And then the part where Lawrence sort of hinted that he thought she was the coolest person he'd ever met sank in as well, even if it was just a rhetorical supposition. "And you know these people way better than I do," Lawrence said, "but it strikes me that this thing about aggrandizement is a way of controlling you. They don't want you to use your power, except for however they tell you to." At last, the rain stopped, and Patricia had dried out except for her shoes. They headed for two separate bus stops, although their route coincided for 4 blocks. They hugged goodbye. When Patricia got home, she gazed at her caddy while brushing her teeth, like a blank mirror, and it filled her in on everything she'd missed. Before she sank into her bed, she tossed the caddy back in her shoulder bag. Chapter 21. Sometimes Lawrence zoned out and imagined walking on another Earth-like planet. The weird gravity. The different mix of oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen in the air. Types of life that might defy our definitions of plant or animal. More than one moon. Maybe more than one sun. His heart could burst, just with the newness of it. Digging bare feet into soil that no human toes had plowed. Under a brazen sky that proclaimed all the things we had thought our limits were merely our prejudices. And then he snapped back to the reality that his team was stuck. No closer to opening up the final frontier than a year earlier. He would come out of his reverie to find another email from Milton, who wanted progress reports that included actual progress. These emails contained phrases like, "Humanity strides along a widening precipice." Some days, Lawrence struggled to motivate himself to go into work, and once there, he couldn't bring himself to leave. When he talked to Serafina about his work,
He kept the details vague. As far as Serafina knew, his team was working on a theoretical anti-gravity thing that could yield some practical application years from now, if ever. But he longed to show off the finished product to Serafina and spread his arms wide as the pathway to infinity burst open behind him. That would be the crowning moment of his life. Which is why, when Priya said she wanted to be the first weightless person on Earth, Lawrence scarcely hesitated. Priya had these amazing hands that she gestured with when she talked, and it was like she was making shapes in your brain. Her fingers were long and rippled with indentations, and she wore chunky rings with big fake sapphires, plus pastel acrylic nails. Saugata had been staring at Priya for weeks across the hack-olective, watching her solder, wearing safety goggles that only made her look more elfin. She constructed some kind of wireless-enabled burrowing robot that could hide small objects where you'd never find them without the right PGP key. Lawrence was like, "You should sneak her up here and show her the antigrav and the not-quite-antimatter. She'll be yours forever, man." Anya and Tanea fought against letting Priya inside their headquarters on the grounds that she would tell everyone else in the Hacko elective and there would be drama. The hackerspace had some cool people, but there were also people who still thought it was awesome to build your own 2-second time machine. "We're doing serious research here," said Tanea. "Nothing is a toy. Well, except for Six-Fingered Steve." She gestured at the tiny tap-dancing robot, who heard his name and made jazz hands with too many digits. Disturbing, as always. "This is a top-secret research facility, disguised as a clubhouse," concurred Anya, who was wearing jodhpurs and riding boots, plus a puffy T-shirt with Debbie Harry on it, with a belt around Debbie's neck. Anya had just dyed her hair candy pink. Lawrence and Saugata both looked around the loft, with the exposed ceiling beams and posters for the Gossip and James Bond movies, plus beanbags and a corduroy sofa. The disco ball doubled as a security system. The clubhouse disguise was very cunning indeed. Soon enough, Priya was flexing one long, sparkly finger at Six-Fingered Steve and watching him dance. "His reaction time is impressive," she said, with only a slight Punjabi accent. "I would have given him some kind of central gyro for balance." After a couple hours hanging out and tinkering, Priya was like part of the group, and she swore on all that was unholy not to tell anybody else about their hideaway. Lawrence explained to her about the anti-gravity thing. "The goal is to negate gravity, to change the spin of all the electrons in your body so that your mass is effectively shunted somewhere else." "Like another dimension," Priya said, "because of the theory that gravity is a stronger force in other universes." "Yes," said Tanea. "So you will still be here, but your mass would be elsewhere." "All of this is just a means to an end, though," added Saugata. "We think if we can solve the gravity problem, we can create stable worm..." Anya kicked him, and he coughed and said, "Pie. Worm pie." "Mmm," said Priya. "Worm pie. My favorite." "It's a delicacy," said Lawrence. "Someplace. We don't know where, but we're going to go there and enter a contest once we've perfected our recipe." A couple weeks passed. Everybody got used to having Priya around. Meanwhile, the team finally had some real success with the machine. First a golf ball, then a baseball, then a boiled egg, then a hamster named Ben. They all let slip their surly bonds at the flick of a button, then returned to normal weight at a second button press.
In theory, a person could crouch on the glowy white disc with the giant red nozzle aimed at it and be bathed in the full effect of the anti-gravitation rays. But I'd want to do a lot more testing before doing any human subjects experimentation, said Anya.
Can I try it?
Priya said.
I want to be the first weightless person on Earth, so my name can be misspelled in every record book, forever and ever.
Anya started to protest, but then Priya said,
Conventional Newtonian gravitation is so last year.
Everybody giggled. Priya always knew just the right things to say. The others looked at Lawrence, who slowly nodded.
Yes, he said. I think we can make that happen.
An hour later, Lawrence was frantically dialing Patricia, praying that she hadn't left her cell phone at home or turned it off for some witchy festival. She picked up, and he started talking immediately.
Hey, I desperately need your help. We have tampered with forces that people were not meant to fuck around with, and we seem to have pushed Saugata's girlfriend into another plane of existence, where we have no way of locating her or even proving that she still exists, and we've basically exhausted all scientific options, and don't worry, I won't tell the others about your secret. Just please help.
Wait a minute, Patricia said.
Saugata has a girlfriend now?
We didn't account for the extra mass and the correspondingly greater level of attraction in the other universe, said Lawrence, as if that answered her question.
I'll be there in a few, Patricia said. I'm just up the street.
When Patricia got to the cement blockhouse and Lawrence came down to let her in, she barely had time to impress upon him the fact that his friends must not find out about her skills, no matter what.
Sure, sure, said Lawrence. Of course. Soul of discretion. No worries at all. Just please, please, if you can, please help. I will be in your debt forever.
He was climbing the stairs behind her, and as they reached the top step, Patricia turned and practically glared at him.
Never, ever say that to me.
Incandescent.
Say what?
The thing about being in my debt. It has a different meaning for me than it does for most people.
Oh, right. Okay, well, I will be super grateful. Anyway, it's over here.
Saugata, Anya, and Taneya stared at the shining white circle under the big ray gun barrel and didn't acknowledge Patricia's arrival until she was standing next to them.
What's she doing here? Saugata said.
She can help, Lawrence said. I can't explain, but she can help.
What's her area of expertise again? Anya folded her arms over her unicorn shirt.
Dimensional transcendentalism, said Patricia.
You just stole that from Doctor Who. This isn't a joke. This is serious, Anya said.
Okay, look, Patricia said. Do you guys want your friend back or not?
Everybody nodded, slowly.
Then just stand the fuck back and let me work.
Everybody kept clustering around Patricia and trying to see what she was doing, and Lawrence worried that she was going to put so much energy into obfuscation that she wouldn't be able to reach into the hole in the universe and pull Priya out. Patricia was wearing a strapless red dress that teased you with the sweep of her pale shoulders and a hint of cleavage. As she turned her back to Lawrence and stared into the space over the white circle, he couldn't help noticing the dimples behind her knees and the perfect curves of her calves and ankles. Lawrence still wasn't entirely sure what had happened to Priya. He had no real data. She'd floated, the way Ben and the various objects had. Her sandals had fallen as her feet lifted off, and her bright toenails had wriggled. She'd laughed and clapped her hands and said, "Suck on this, Newton!" Everybody was high-fiving and making upskirting jokes. And then she'd just gone pop. It was sort of a balloon-popping, squelching sound, as if something sucked her into an invisible hole. All that remained were her sandals,
one of which was upside down. Lawrence had felt a compulsion to pick them up, then place them neatly beside each other next to the beanbag, as if she'd come back for them in a moment. Patricia turned and gestured to Lawrence that she needed some space here. He grabbed Saugata's arm and dragged him toward the exit, beckoning for Anya and Tanea to follow. "We need to get her some supplies," Lawrence said. "Patricia needs boiling water, dry ice, regular ice, half a dozen jailbroken caddies, and a few other things. Come on, people, let's haul ass." He hustled them out of there.
"If this doesn't work," said Saugata.
"If you're just wasting our time while Priya is in danger," said Anya.
"We will end you," Tanea concluded.
Lawrence looked back at the steel door, which he'd slammed shut behind them, and inhaled loudly through his teeth. He felt as if he, too, were about to be sucked into a completely unknowable other space.
"Let's hurry up and get those supplies," he said.
He kept adding more and more items to the list, some of which they'd need to purchase at the grocery store or borrow from people in the hackerspace a few blocks away.
"Damn, damn, damn," Saugata kept saying under his breath. "Damn, it's all over. I'm so sorry, Priya."
Anya put her hand on Saugata's shoulder. Lawrence was putting a lot of energy into pretending that the scavenger hunt he was sending his friends on was vital and time-sensitive. And then he looked down at his phone and saw a text from Patricia. "Come back, please. Alone." He gestured for the others to go out for supplies, then turned and sprinted back upstairs. The loft looked darker than usual, as if all the light were being eaten by something. The movie posters resembled ghost portraits in a haunted mansion. Lawrence stepped in a beanbag and almost face-planted. He crept past machines that he worked with every day, which suddenly looked sinister with their sharp edges, metallic protrusions, and sputtering LEDs. There was a rank, beautiful scent, akin to burning lavender. Patricia glowed at the other end of the long, thin space, with the same pale light as the white circle where Priya had vanished, the only point of brightness in the entire space.
"How's it going?"
Lawrence Stage whispered, as though they were in a crypt.
"It's going okay," Patricia said in a normal voice. "Priya is safe for now. She's going to need a lot of vodka and loud music when she gets out of where she is. She drinks, right? She's not straight edge."
"She drinks," Lawrence said. That Priya's taste in intoxicants was an issue reassured him a lot, but he was waiting for the bad news. Patricia just stared at him as if she was trying to decide something. She was several inches shorter than him, but in this moment she seemed taller. Her deep-set eyes narrowed as she sized him up.
"So," Lawrence said after a moment of this, "what can I do?"
"Remember what I told you not to say to me," Patricia said, "when you brought me up here?" Lawrence had another standing on the edge of the abyss feeling, total heedless terror. He shrugged, and it passed.
"Sure," he said, "I remember."
"I need you to owe me something," Patricia said, "or this won't work." "I'm really sorry. I tried to do it every other way, and none of them succeeded. In the end, the most powerful magic is often transactional in some way. I'll explain more some other time."
"Okay, sure," Lawrence said. "Whatever you want. Name it."
"If I bring your friend back," Patricia said. She chewed her lip and seemed to be trying one last time to think of an alternative. "If I bring your friend back, you have to give me the smallest thing you own."
"That's it?"
Lawrence laughed with relief.
"Done."
He grabbed her hand with both hands and shook. Lawrence couldn't stop laughing because he'd gotten himself all worked up, and it turned out to be nothing. He owned so many tiny items. The smallest thing he owned was probably some ridiculous gadget he'd paid too much for. He laughed until he croaked, and his eyes clouded, and when he wiped his eyes clear, Patricia and he were no longer alone. Priya stood on the white platform for a moment, gaping at the two faces below. She raised her elegant hands to her face, as if astonished to see that she still had hands. She tried to form words and just made a fish mouth instead. She started to wobble off the platform, and Lawrence guided her to sit down. "She's seen some things that eyes weren't built for," Patricia said. "Like I said, vodka, and lots of it, and loud music. I recommend Bender's. I'll even come and have a drink or two." Lawrence steered Priya onto a beanbag, where she was hugging herself and making low guttural sounds. He texted the others to come back up, then turned back to Patricia. "Oh my God, thank you," Lawrence said. "Am I allowed to say thank you, or is that bad?" "You're allowed to say thank you," Patricia laughed. He ran over and hugged her so tight he nearly squeezed the life out of her, and he felt her bare shoulders against his chest and her face against his neck. She made a slight protesting squeak noise, and Lawrence slackened a tiny bit, but kept hugging her. "Thank you, thank you, thank you." Lawrence's eyes felt splashy, his senses filled with clementines and softness and warmth. He blessed the day his parents decided he should be outdoorsy. The others had come back, and Saugata was life-preserving Priya with tears rushing down his face. "I thought I'd lost you forever. I couldn't have lived with myself. I never want to let go of you," he said. "There were colors outside the visual spectrum," Priya managed to say, "but I could still see them. I can't stop seeing them now." "Vodka and loud music," Patricia called out from Lawrence's death grip. "Stat! It's an essential part of her recovery process." They rushed Priya to Bender's Bar and Grill. There was some talk of going to the ER instead, but Patricia nixed it, and nobody wanted to argue with the person who'd saved all their asses.
"But how did you do it?" Anya kept asking. "What did you do?"
"I used my sonic screwdriver."
"No, really. What did you do?"
"I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow."
"Stop giving Doctor Who answers. Tell me the truth."
"It was sort of a wibbly-wobbly," Patricia said, fully teasing Anya now. Booze really was medicinal, after a near-death experience. Holding a drink in both hands and letting it corrode the topmost layer of his mouth and throat, Lawrence felt a spiritual relationship with Bushmills. Priya, too, seemed to be pretty much back to normal as soon as she had a couple swigs of vodka and heard the sound system blasting, "Come on, feel the noise." She started dancing on her stool and making jokes about heavy metal hair and body shots. Lawrence made sure the liquor kept coming, so Priya would get her recommended dosage. Whatever she'd experienced during her time outside of our universe, she seemed to be rinsing it out of her mind. And maybe if they were lucky, the whole evening would feel like a weird blur to her when she woke with a hangover. As a strategy for scrambling someone's short-term memories, it didn't seem bad. Everybody kept toasting Patricia and buying her drinks and laughing at her dumb jokes as if they were ultra-conscious that she'd pulled their fat out of the fire. When Patricia went to the ladies, Saugata leaned over and said to Lawrence, "Seriously, where did you find her? She is amazing. She's like the weirdest genius I've ever met, and that's actually saying something." Tanea and Anya both chimed in, but at the same time, Lawrence noticed that none of his friends would quite look at Patricia, and they kept talking past her rather than to her. These people hated superstition, but they were treating his friend like a bad luck charm.
Patricia watched Priya like a freaking hawk and touched her hand every now and then, as if her touch had healing properties, which it probably did. Patricia paid no attention to the rest of them, even Lawrence. Patricia might be an antisocial weirdo who wandered at 3 in the morning talking to rats, but she had unlimited gentleness for people when they needed it. Patricia's black hair was swept back, and her face had a beacon-like quality to it that went along with the intentness of her gaze. Lawrence had a moment of counting up how many of his secrets Patricia knew, and feeling good about it. He felt a weird sense of pride that he had found someone he trusted so much, like he'd chosen well, even if it was mostly by accident. He walked her home, fighting the urge to embrace her randomly. She was laughing and shaking her head. "God, it was iffy for a few moments there," she said. "Your friend got pretty lost. Plus, it's a miracle she didn't get squashed by the weird gravitational effects of the space she was in." "I wonder how many other things in our world are just the shadows of things in other places," Lawrence said, forming the thought as he spoke. "I mean, we always suspected that gravity was so weak in our world, because most of it was in another dimension. But what else? Light? Time? Some of our emotions? I mean, the longer I live, the more I feel like the stuff I see and feel is like a tracing of the outline of the real stuff that's beyond our perceptions."
"Like Plato's cave," Patricia said.
"Like Plato's cave," Lawrence agreed.
"I don't know," Patricia said. "I mean, we're grown-ups now, allegedly, and we feel things less than we did when we were kids, because we've grown so much scar tissue.
Or our senses have dulled. I think it's probably healthy. I mean, little kids don't have to make decisions, unless something's very wrong. Maybe you can't make up your mind as easily if you feel too much, you know?" But in fact, Lawrence was feeling sensations and emotions more vividly than he had since he was little. The streetlights and car headlights and neon signs were blazing with life, and he felt his heart expand and contract, and he could smell charcoal burning someplace nearby. He turned to look into Patricia's bright, sad smile.
"Patricia," he said, "I really, really appreciate your help. And more than that, I am so damn glad to know you. I am so sorry I ran out on you when you talked to your cat when we were kids. I will never run out on you again. That's a promise I'm giving you, free and clear. I'm probably not supposed to make promises to someone like you either, right? But I don't care. Thank you for being my friend."
"You're welcome," Patricia said. They had reached her front door. "Same to you. All of it. I'm super lucky to have you as a friend, too. And I'll never run out on you either." They stood at her door. At some point, their hands had started touching, and they just stood there, looking at each other, hands in hands. Patricia's smile turned sadder, as if she knew something that Lawrence hadn't figured out yet.
"Don't forget the thing you owe me," she said, "or it'll be very bad. I'm sorry." Then she went inside her house, and the door slammed shut. Lawrence was still jangling with a mixture of tipsiness, relief, and emotional gushiness the whole way home. But he was also feeling a smidge uneasy about the smallest thing. No big deal, most likely, but Patricia had seemed kind of intense about it. Lawrence actually clicked his heels together as he crossed the street in big, hungry strides. He had never done ecstasy or any kind of mood elevator, but he sort of imagined this is how they would feel. When he got home, he crashed. The elation wore off so fast he had to sit down. He was so drained, he felt like he was going to pass out if he didn't get to sleep right away. And then he thought about the smallest thing that he had to give to Patricia. He could look for it in the morning, or in a couple days, or whatever. She hadn't specified a time limit or anything. He probably had a few days to find it.
But then Lawrence started wondering what it could be and how he was supposed to know. Was it the smallest by volume, by weight, or just overall size? He owned some pieces of lint that were beyond tiny, but he was pretty sure that wouldn't count. To be fair, he had to pick something he owned, which meant something that had at least a nominal resale value. You don't own something you couldn't sell, right? So, he had a USB drive that he'd brought home from the 10% project office, which was the size of two peas, but when he texted Patricia, she said it couldn't be something he'd borrowed. She needed something he owned himself, free and clear. That ruled out the electronic components and tools littering his desk and shelves, which were all technically on loan from Milton. Lawrence rummaged through his desk. Pencils, pens, that little figurine of Mega Man was pretty tiny. Move that to the top of the list. He started a pile and rummaged through drawers and boxes and closet shelves, trying not to wake Isabel. And then, all at once, he knew. "Oh, no," he said aloud. "Not that. No, no, no. Fuck. Fuck, no." He couldn't breathe, like an asthma attack or something. All of the joy he'd felt earlier slipped away as if it had never been there, and he felt instead like he'd been kicked in the solar plexus with a sharp steel toe. He stayed up most of the rest of the night, searching and searching, but he never found anything that counted as a real possession and was smaller than his grandmother's ring. He brought it to Patricia the next morning, eyes sore from lack of sleep. "This is the only thing I have of my grandmother's," he told her. "She gave it to me when she was dying." "I'm sorry," Patricia said. She stood in the doorway of her apartment building, in a bathrobe. Maybe he'd woken her, but he doubted it. "She said it was her mother's, and she wanted to pass it down to a granddaughter, but I was her only grandchild," Lawrence said. "She wanted me to give it to whoever I married, and then to our daughter, if we had one."
"I'm really sorry," Patricia said.
"I was going to give it to Serafina," Lawrence said, "as an engagement ring. I promised my grandma I would give it to my bride."
Patricia didn't say anything, just stared in her purple robe. Her hair was a pile of tangles.
"I really have to give it to you? We can't just call it quits?"
"You really have to, or your friend might get sucked back into that place, or you might instead."
When she put it like that, the ring was a pretty small price to pay. "You knew it was going to be this."
He handed it to her, still in its tiny, tiny velvet box.
Actually, with the box, it was almost bigger than a toy car he owned, but not quite.
"I knew it would be something like this."
Patricia put the ring into the pocket of her robe, where it barely made a lump.
"Or the spell wouldn't have worked."
"Why couldn't it just be something like, I have to stand on one foot for an hour? Why does it have to be my most valued possession and the linchpin of my courting strategy? It doesn't make any sense."
"Do you want to come in and have some toaster waffles?"
Patricia stepped back and held the door open.
"I can't talk about this out here, in the open."
The toaster waffles failed to materialize, but instead she had locally made organic Pop-Tarts, which were probably better. They sat on the gray, lumpy sofa, where Dee Dee and the other roommate had been watching Jersey Shore every other time Lawrence had been there. Patricia kept glancing over toward the hallway for any signs they were stirring or listening in to this conversation.
"So I might have mentioned there are two kinds of magic."
Patricia handed Lawrence a blueberry pastry and a mug of English breakfast. "Good and bad, I'm guessing," said Lawrence, not quite having his mouth full. Patricia's bathrobe was splayed out on the sofa next to him, and he wondered if he could grab the ring while she wasn't looking. But then he remembered the part about someone getting pulled back into the nightmare dimension.
"No,
though that's a common misconception. There's healer magic and trickster magic. Back in the day, many people believed healer magic was good and trickster magic was evil. But healers can be judgmental control freaks, and tricksters can be super compassionate and basically save your life. Like last night, Lawrence said. Patricia nodded. The healer and trickster schools formed over hundreds of years out of lots of local traditions from all over the world. And there was a time, in the 1830s, when the two groups went to war. The world could have been torn apart. But there was this woman named Hortense Walker who realized that the two types of magic worked better if you could combine them. You could do amazing things if you mastered both trickster and healer magic, way more than you could do with either type alone. Plus, you were less likely to go over the edge into becoming a control freak or a lying jerkface. Lawrence was already jumping ahead to the implications. So, if you want to accomplish something major using magic, you need to trick someone or heal them. So you're helpless without a patsy or a sick person. I wouldn't say helpless. I spent years training to use these skills in lots of different situations. I can use trickster magic to transform myself, even with nobody around. And if someone attacked me, I could heal them so hard they'd feel it for a week. Thanks for explaining. Lawrence ate the last corner of his blueberry pouch and then washed it down with the rest of the tea. He had 100 more questions, but he wasn't equipped to hear any more answers right now. He sank deeper into the broken upholstery of the couch. He would never, ever be able to pull his butt out of this sofa. He was just going to get dragged in deeper until he was swallowed, as if by a Venus ass trap. Every quadrant of Lawrence's soul was yelling for him to get the hell out of there before he lost more than his grandmother's ring and his freedom of speech. But then he thought about the other promise he'd made the night before, the one he made of his own free will. "I said I wouldn't ever run away again," Lawrence said. "And I won't." "Good." Patricia let out a breath that sounded like she'd held it for ages. "More tea?" "Sure." Lawrence found a marginally more comfortable arrangement on the couch, and Patricia handed him a fresh hot mug. They drank tea together in silence until Patricia's roommates woke up and started giving Lawrence the hairy eyeball. Chapter 22. Patricia had spent years wishing she could run away to learn real magic. Then one day, she turned herself into a bird, and a man came to take her to the Witch Academy. Dreams? Fulfilled. El Tisley Mays had two separate campuses, and they were as different as a cloudless summer day and a blizzard. El Tisley Hall had grand stone buildings over 600 years old, and nobody ever raised his or her voice there. Students at El Tisley walked single file along the gravel walkways, wearing blazers, ties, and shorts, with the school's crest over their hearts, a bear and stag face to face, holding a flaming chalice between them. You addressed your teachers or upperclassmen as sir or miss, and ate in formal hall in the greater building. The maze, meanwhile, was a disorienting jumble of nine-faced buildings and looping walkways, where you could wear whatever you pleased. You could sleep all day, do drugs, play video games, do anything you fancied. Except that you would find yourself trapped in a room with no door, or toilet, for weeks, until you learned some crazy lesson. Or you would be tossed into a bottomless pit, or chased around for days by people with sticks. Or you would find yourself unable to stop tap dancing. Or pieces of you might start falling off, one by one. Nobody told you anything in the maze. Once, El Tisley Hall and the maze had been two separate schools, representing two styles of magic that were at odds. But now they were joined because magic had been united at great cost. The passage between them was a sandy, hedge-lined walkway that only opened at certain times. Patricia would spend weeks mastering some delicate healing art at El Tisley Hall, and then they would send her back to the maze, and she would be so confused and tangled up in herself that she forgot all her fancy skills. She would solve some nonsense puzzle at the maze, and figure out how to do some clever trick, only to be sent back to El Tisley Hall, where they'd drum endless rules and formula into her again, and she would lose the twisty shape she'd been holding in her mind. This would have been enough to make her cry into her pillow every night at lights out, at El Tisley, or impromptu nap time at the maze. But also, Patricia missed her parents, whom she hadn't even said goodbye to. For all they knew, she was dead, or living in some alley like an animal. She wanted to tell them she was okay, but she wouldn't know how to explain. Not to mention, she'd left her cat, Berkeley. The head teacher at El Tisley Hall was a gentle old lady named Carmen Edelstein. She wore her silver hair in a dignified page boy and always had an elegant silk wrap around her neck and shoulders. Carmen encouraged the students to come to her with any problems or questions, and Patricia soon found herself confiding in the old lady. But she learned the hard way that she must not mention her encounter with some sort of tree spirit a few years earlier. Magic was a practice and an art, not a spiritual belief system. You might have your own private spiritual experiences, just like any normal person, but believing you had a direct line to something great and ancient was the beginning of aggrandizement.
"Trees do not talk to people," said Carmen Edelstein,
her usual cheer replaced by a worried scowl.
"You had a hallucination, or someone was playing a trick. This is why it's terrible that we get so many students so late, after they have already experimented on their own. Those bad habits can be a nightmare to unlearn."
"It was probably a hallucination, sure." Patricia squirmed in her stiff chair. "I remember I had eaten a lot of spicy food."
The head teacher at the maze was Canote, whose face and voice changed every time you met him. Sometimes he was an elderly Sri Lankan man, sometimes a pygmy, sometimes a giant white man with a crazy neck beard. Patricia soon learned to recognize Canote by certain tells, like the way he rolled his shoulders or narrowed his left eye. If you failed to identify him or misidentified someone else as him, you would find yourself at the bottom of the deepest pit in the maze. Other than the bottomless one, that is. People said that if Canote ever wore the same face twice, he would die. Whenever you met Canote, he'd offer you a terrible bargain. Patricia didn't try to tell Canote about the tree. Patricia had no real friends at El Tisley Maze. She was friendly with a few of the other kids, including Taylor, who had messy, mouse-brown hair and ungainly, twitchy arms and legs. But the main cliques at the school never found a place for Patricia, especially after it was clear that she kind of sucked at most of the school assignments. Nobody wanted to befriend someone who was both nerdy and bad at homework. If you went out into the tree line near El Tisley Hall at a certain time in the late afternoon, or after lights out in the El Tisley dorm, you might have seen a teenage girl with dark brown hair and big, wondering eyes looking up at the trees and saying, "Are you here? What's your deal? Is Parliament in session?" And chattering to the birds, which just glanced at her and flew away. You could never tell how long you would spend at either El Tisley Hall or the maze. It could be days, weeks, or longer. At one point, Patricia spent 7 months in the maze, until she managed to hide from the teachers and the other students, and they all spent a week looking for her. But instead of going back to El Tisley Hall, she was led out into a yellow grass field, where Canote himself ushered Patricia and some other students into a great wooden airship, which was whale-shaped, except it had more fins, with an interior that was covered with rococo nuts and berries. Today, Canote was a heavy-set, bespectacled African-American man with a Tennessee accent and a bomber jacket.
Here's the idea, he said, when they were already over the Alps somewhere. We drop each one of you guys in a small town, someplace where you don't speak the language. No money, no supplies. And you find a person who needs healing. Someone hurting real bad, and you heal them, without them knowing you were ever there. Then we come get you. Canote offered to let the students out of this assignment in exchange for letting him hide some stuff in their bones. But nobody went for it. So instead, he started shoving kids one by one out of the airship's hatch, which looked like the doorway of a French chateau a few hundred feet up. No parachute. Patricia managed to slow her descent, so the impact just knocked the wind out of her. She staggered to her feet, in a field miles from anywhere. Then she wandered until nightfall, when she saw the lights of the town behind her. The first few people she found seemed healthy enough, but then she noticed an old woman hunched over a bowl of soup in a small restaurant or bistro. The woman was coughing, and her skin looked gray, and Patricia could glimpse an ochre scar poking out of the neck of her yellow blouse. Perfect. Patricia crept toward the woman, only to get a faceful of soup and what sounded like accusations of thievery in some Slavic language. She ran. A week later, Patricia was starving and running out of places to hide in this town, with its dingy white plaster walls and muddy roads. She could no longer talk to animals, and she had failed to master the skill of understanding human languages other than English. Plus, she could only heal a sick person with whom she'd built a certain rapport. "I am so not going to sleep in these same clothes again tonight," Patricia said aloud, in English. The shopkeeper in the tiny grocery saw her and chased her out, shouting guttural syllables. Patricia ran down the narrow twisting streets, sharp inclines paved with cobblestones, until she had lost the shopkeeper. She squatted behind a stone wall and looked at the only thing she'd been able to steal. A dusty bottle of Chiang Mai brand chili oil. "This better work." Patricia tilted the bottle so the words, "Warning, red hot," were upside down. The thick liquid singed her throat. She started to gag, but she made herself drink the whole thing. Once the bottle was empty, she pulled herself into a shivering ball. Her head ached. She wanted to weep for everything she'd lost and all she'd failed to gain. An hour later, she raised her head and threw up. Once she started, she couldn't stop. Her eyes burned and her nose ran, and the oil was twice as horrible coming up as going down. Her stomach spasmed, not amused by her idea of a meal after days of starvation. She coughed acid. The good news. Patricia had an idea how to heal the angry old woman now. Patricia crept across the slate rooftops of the town until she reached the sloping roof of the cantina, where she could see the woman through a small skylight. The skylight was open, and she slipped inside, tiptoeing across a loft where bags of flour and cans of supplies were stored. She hesitated before taking some bread and stuffing it in her mouth. Then she reached the edge of the loft, still on the other side of the glorified barn from where the woman sat at her rickety table. Patricia shinnied up a support pillar and then onto a ceiling beam. She inched her way across the beam until she was hanging by her arms and legs over the old woman and leaned as far as she could without losing her grip. Patricia spat in the old woman's soup. The old woman was hectoring someone else in the room, probably about kids these days, and didn't notice. Once Patricia's saliva was inside the woman, she had a direct link and could take stock of the late-stage emphysema. The barely-in-remission cancer that had already cost the old woman a lung, and the gout. It took an hour of concentration and some unseemly muttering for Patricia to get in there and make the woman's insides as good as new. She stopped just short of giving the crone a lung to replace the one she'd lost. The night sky looked overcrowded to Patricia as she lay in the uneven grass of the field where she'd fallen out of the airship. Too many stars, trying too hard. She lay there for an hour before the airship descended far enough to lower a ladder for her. She climbed slowly, her limbs sore and feeble. Connaught handed her a sandwich and a can of ginger ale and tried to sell her some shares in a Zumba studio. This time, Connaught was a young German with a shaved head. After that, Patricia started figuring out how to use the things she'd learned at El Tisley at the maze, and how to use the maze's craftiness at El Tisley. A few kids had dropped out after the random Eastern European town assignment, so space opened up for Patricia to become an honorary member of a few cliques. One night, she was smoking clove cigarettes with the cool goth kids after curfew, inside the cavernous and never-used chimney of El Tisley's lesser building. There was Diantha, the plump, swan-like leader of the group, who was rumored to be the daughter of an earl or something. Next to Patricia sat Taylor, who'd gone full-on goth with the hair dye and eyeliner and a leather jacket after hours. On Patricia's other side was Samir, who wore black starched collar shirts that made his shy, slightly horsey face look grown up and sophisticated. Plus Toby, a Scottish kid with wiry red hair and jug ears, and a few other kids who showed up sometimes. The red brick chimney walls had streaks of ancient soot on them. Patricia and Taylor rested, arms around each other, and the clove smoke fumigated Patricia's insides. They were trading weird stories about their lives before El Tisley Maze, all the fluky experiences that made them realize they had a connection to some unidentified power. And Patricia found herself talking about what she remembered of the Parliament of Derpa Derpa Weepalong and the tree, before she even knew what she was doing. "That is bizarre," Taylor said. "It is quite amazing," said Diantha, leaning forward and encompassing Patricia with her dark, enthralling eyes. "Do tell us more." Patricia told the whole story again, from the beginning, adding more details this time. The next day, she wondered if she should have kept the tree thing to herself. Was she going to get in trouble? She kept glancing at Carmen Edelstein during literature class. They were reading Troilus and Cressida, but Carmen showed no sign of knowing anything. That night, as Patricia was getting ready for bed, Taylor knocked on her door. "Come on, we're all at the chimney," Taylor said with a grin. The group in the disused chimney was twice as big as before, so there was barely room for Patricia, but everybody wanted to hear about the tree. The more times Patricia told the story, the more like a story it became, with dramatic touches and a better ending. She threw in more details, like the way the wind felt as it passed through her disembodied spirit form, and the way the trees shimmered as she soared on the wind into the heart of the forest. And by the third night, when Patricia was telling the story to a third group of kids, the tree had gotten a lot more eloquent.
"It said you were the protector of nature," said a younger kid from Côte d'Ivoire named Jean-Jacques.
"It said we all were," Patricia said. "The defenders of nature. Against, like, anyone who wanted to harm it. We all are. We have a special purpose. That's what the tree said, anyway. It was like the perfect tree at the heart of the forest that you can only find if someone shows it to you. A bird took me when I was very small."
"Can you take us to it?" asked Jean-Jacques, so excited he couldn't breathe.
Soon they had a proper club. They got together at night, a dozen kids, and talked about how they were going to find the heart of the forest, the way Patricia had. And how they were going to protect nature from anyone who wanted to harm her, like the Na'vi. Patricia was the one with the knowledge, but Diantha was the one who could say, "We are all of one accord," and everybody would cheer.
"We are all counting on you," Diantha said to Patricia in low, confiding tones, touching her shoulder. Patricia felt a thrill all the way down to her tailbone. "And the tree was huge, like 40 or 50 feet tall, and it wasn't an oak or a maple or any kind I'd seen before. It had branches like big wings, and the moonlight came through the thickest part of the branches in two places, so it looked like two glowing eyes looking at me. The voice was like this friendly earthquake."
The 10th time that Patricia told the story about the night after she left her body and went to the tree, the tale had gotten embroidered to the point where it bore little resemblance to the version Patricia had told that first night. And yet, everybody was bored with it. They wanted to know what happened next.
"What do we do?"
Samir asked. "What's our next move?"
"I honestly don't know," Patricia said. She told them, for the first time, about when she was in Bogtown, and she guzzled chili oil, and nothing happened.
They traded theories, like it wasn't the right time, or she wasn't in the right headspace, or you couldn't reach the tree from Eastern Europe because of ley lines. Opinions among Diantha's secret club were divided over the crucial question. Did the adults at El Tisley Maze know about the tree? Either A, it was something all the adults knew about, and they were just keeping it secret from the kids because they weren't ready to know about it yet. Or, B, they didn't know about it, and this was something you had to be a kid to understand. A few days later, Patricia had lunch with Diantha. Alone. They had a blanket on the east lawn of El Tisley Hall, where every blade of grass was perfect. Patricia still couldn't quite believe that Diantha was hanging out with her. Diantha had this way of widening her eyes just before saying something to you, so you found yourself looking into her gaze and you felt sure that whatever she said next would be the most important thing you'd ever heard. She wore her El Tisley scarf so elegantly, you'd think she'd picked it out of 1,000 scarf options. Her brown hair caught the light.
"We're going to do so many great things together, you and I. I just know it,"
Diantha told Patricia.
"You should have some fizzy lemonade. They don't have fizzy lemonade where you're from, and it's really quite good."
Patricia did what she was told. The lemonade was like a more lemony Sprite, and it was the coolest thing. The bubbles popped on her tongue. Patricia wondered if Diantha was going to kiss her. Diantha was leaning in close, and they were gazing into each other's eyes. Patricia had never thought of herself as lesbian, but Diantha smelled so good and had such a powerful presence. It wasn't even like paltry sexual attraction. Somewhere off in the distance, a bird sang, and Patricia almost understood. Even the kids who didn't hang out in the disused chimney gave Patricia a look of envy or appreciation when she walked into the El Tisley dining hall. Or when she foraged in the self-service canteen at the maze, where you never knew if there would be pizza or black pudding. People in the maze told Patricia they liked her jeans. Nobody had ever liked her jeans before.
"I have something very important to tell all of you."
Diantha sounded breathless, and not just because there were 10 teenagers packed inside a dirty little chimney at midnight. 10 pairs of hands clutched, 10 pelvises twitched with anticipation, as if they all collectively had to pee. Diantha held the pause as long as she could, then dropped the bomb.
"I have spoken with the tree."
"What?" Patricia said before she could stop herself. "I mean, that's great. How did you manage to do that?" Everybody was staring at Patricia, like she'd had a jealous outburst or something, instead of just being surprised. It wasn't that Patricia had a monopoly on talking to the tree or anything. She had only done it once herself, and that was years ago. Patricia stammered something else about how happy she was that Diantha had done it, because this was great news, really great. Diantha made things 100 times worse, patting Patricia on the knee and saying,
"Don't worry, dearest. We still value your contribution most of all."
But screw Patricia's wounded pride. Everybody wanted to know, what had the tree said? What was the message? They were so ready. They were beyond ready.
"The tree said," Diantha said, "to prepare ourselves. The test is coming soon. And not all of us will pass it, but those who do will be heroes, forever and ever."
Everybody was so happy, they were whimpering. That didn't sound like the way the tree had talked to Patricia, at all. But she'd only had one conversation a few years ago, and she had a dim recall of the details, especially now that she'd retold them so many times.
Patricia told herself to feel glad that she'd been vindicated, and she hadn't just hallucinated the whole thing after all, instead of asking Diantha a bunch of questions, which would just be a sign of jealousy. And aggrandizement. Now the tree was talking to Diantha instead of Patricia. Big whoop.
"I was up all night studying for a healing tonics exam," said Diantha. "And I ate a great quantity of spicy papadum crisps. The next thing I knew, I was soaring out of my body, out the window, into the night. It was the most exhilarating sensation."
For a fortnight, the tree wasn't forthcoming with any more information, although it spoke to Diantha a few more times. Samir held hands with Patricia as they listened to the hints that this was something ancient, from before any of the lore they studied, from before words. Samir's hand felt dry and calloused, and his index finger touched Patricia's pinky in a way that made her feel funny inside. They were both fixated on Diantha, whose exquisite nostrils flared as she talked about her out-of-body experience. On Patricia's other side, Taylor shivered. Everybody who met in that chimney had a secret wink. Where you put your thumb in the middle of your collarbone while you winked with one eye, then the other. And they wrote sigils inside their clothes. When the tree did give Diantha actual instructions, they were cryptic.
It said, "Stop the pipe and passage."
Her eyes widened, and she looked supercharged with adrenaline.
It repeated every word twice.
"The pipe and passage?" said Samir. "That sounds like a gentleman's club, full of tobacco smoke and secret entrances."
"It sounds obscene, yeah?"
said Toby the ginger. He made a motion to show how pipe and passage could be construed smuttily. Diantha gave him a glance that made him fold inward. They spent days debating and Googling and whispering the words pipe and passage to one another, with no idea what they could mean. Diantha seemed impatient, as though she was waiting for someone else to figure out the meaning, so she wasn't forced to be messenger and interpreter both. At last, on Friday after lights out, Diantha took a drag on a clove cigarette and announced she had the answer.
Pipe, it turned out, referred to the Great Siberian Natural Gas Pipeline.
And passage referred to the Great Northern Shipping Passage. They were both the brain children of Lamar Tucker, a Texan who had helped pioneer slick water fracking, in partnership with a Russian conglomerate called Vilkitsky Shipping. The Russians wanted a new shipping route to replace the Northwest Passage, one that avoided Canada altogether, going through the heart of the Arctic ice. There was just one catch. Their route went straight through a massive deposit of ancient methane clathrate in the Chukchi Sea that had been trapped under the ice for millions of years. Scientists warned that releasing all that methane at once could supercharge the effects of climate change overnight. Hence the pipeline. Tucker believed you could drill down by inches, release the pressure slowly, and trap the still-frozen methane by bonding it with silicates. Then you could pipe the energy-rich methane sludge to a facility in Yakutsk. You'd generate enough electricity to power half of eastern Russia, and maybe sell surplus power to Mongolia, China, or even Japan.
"But it's going to go wrong. I know it," said Diantha. "They have no idea what they're tampering with. They must be stopped."
"Yes," said Patricia. "But what are we supposed to do?"
"Do?" said Diantha. "Look around. We are the best students at El Tisley Maze. Between all of us, we have mastered so many skills. Toby, I have seen you unmelt the last snows of spring and reverse 3 days' decay. Samir, you once tricked a bank manager into giving you £500 and the power of invisibility. Patricia, I have heard the teachers whisper that you have a connection to nature that even they don't fully understand. We can do this. The tree depends on us."
They set off that very night, with only what they could carry. Diantha insisted. There could be no delaying and no chance for anybody to have a change of heart and tell the teachers. They all went back to their rooms at El Tisley Hall and stuffed random objects into duffel bags.
"Where are we even going?" Toby said. "I have a practical in 2 days.
At El Tisley, where they expect you to show up."
"We're going AWOL,"
said Taylor with a very quiet whoop.
"No more tests, no more tutorials, no more math class, no more lectures, and no more puzzles at the maze until we finish our mission."
Patricia stuffed a toothbrush and 3 pairs of underwear, plus a tattered copy of Tales of the City, into her satchel. She was going on an adventure. She was going to make a difference. She almost danced down the mahogany staircase in the north residential wing of El Tisley Hall, except that Samir kept shushing her. She squirmed with adrenaline as they broke into the magic airship and spoofed their way past the security questions.
"Hell to the yeah," Patricia said as they spiraled up off the ground. "Let's do this."
She and Taylor high-fived, and then Patricia and Samir hugged while Diantha laughed from the cockpit, whose controls were wooden grapevines and figs. The expedition didn't feel real until they were over the Arctic and the moonlight had given way to 2 sheets of sunlight, sky and ice, both painful to behold. Patricia's joy went sour. She looked out at the vastness below and couldn't tell one bright streak from another.
"We have to hit them before they know we're here," Diantha said from the cockpit. "I hope everybody is prepared for any eventuality."
Patricia, Toby, Samir, and Taylor all said yes.
"We're doing the right thing," Taylor said as they sat down. "We've studied long enough."
Patricia was wishing she'd brought another 3 layers of clothing. She could do a spell to keep herself warm, but it would be a distraction. She wound her scarf around her neck and lower face as many times as it would go.
"Toby, you're on transmutation of metals, because you're our best healer. If it's steel, you turn it to tin," Diantha said as they stepped out of the ship. "Samir and Taylor, you will confuse and confound any opposition we may encounter. I will attempt to seal any borehole in a spectacularly irreparable fashion. And Patricia, you will bring the full fury of nature down on them. Be creative."
They all high-fived and set off across the tundra toward the drilling installation, which looked like a lighthouse on the ice, with a single rusty structure on top of a platform, supported by 4 squat legs connected by the lower half of a pentagram. On one side of the drill was some kind of pumping station with a bulging metal sleeve. On the other side, Patricia saw a huge diesel tank that had probably been airlifted there, and a number of snowmobiles and retrofitted trucks. Looking at a massive tank marked "Warning, Highly Flammable," sitting on top of the world's largest reservoir of methane, Patricia shivered. Her apprehension shaded into terror.
"Guys," Patricia said, "I think we ought to stop and..."
Someone yelled in Russian, and dogs were barking. Guys wearing parkas and goggles drove toward them in a couple snowmobiles, waving what looked like machine guns. Samir and Taylor nodded and ran into their path. A moment later, the guards opened fire, but wildly, in random directions, because Samir had done something to confuse them.
"Watch out!" Patricia shouted. "Don't make them shoot their own fuel to—"
But she couldn't make herself heard over the gunfire, the engines, the yelling, and the dog pack. Toby was already running toward the massive drill, crafting a transmutation of metals spell. Meanwhile, Diantha was marching toward the drill as well, a look of total determination on her beautiful, sun-drenched face. A bullet caught her in the side, and she keeled over. Patricia ran and crouched next to Diantha, who was bleeding like a fountain and panting.
"Hang on," Patricia said. "Looks like the bullet went clean through, but I'm afraid it hit an artery. Hold tight." "Don't waste time on me," Diantha said. "The mission. Focus on the mission."
Patricia kissed Diantha on the mouth, while her hands groped for the hole that was gushing blood. She found the artery and painstakingly, clumsily, repaired it. A bullet sliced past her face. She broke the kiss and said, "Tell me the truth. Did the tree talk to you at all?" Diantha said, "That's a terribly rude question, especially at this juncture." A shout sounded like Toby. "It's all down to you now," Diantha said. "Make them feel the fury." Diantha passed out. Patricia looked up, keeping Diantha's head cradled in her lap. Samir and Taylor had done such a good job creating confusion, she couldn't see what was going on. Snow churned through the air in big tidal waves, and a huge dog, like a husky, sprinted in front of Patricia and then tumbled head over heels. The sound of gunfire was near continuous, like the loudest white noise ever. The wall of snow cleared a little, and Patricia saw a body face down in the snow, wearing an El Tisley scarf. "No, no, no," Patricia muttered. She stood up. She could still fix this. She had to. The attack on the pipeline had lasted maybe 90 seconds. The longer this went on, the more bullets flying in wild directions, the greater the chance of a disaster that would be visible from space. The cold tore into her, and she wished she had goggles like the people trying to kill her. She could barely stand her ground because her center of gravity kept corkscrewing downwards. It was more than just the wind and the snow in her face. Everything felt wonky. She tried to imagine what it would feel like to unleash the forces of nature. What did that even mean? She couldn't even stay upright. How was she going to command any natural forces? The magnetic flux here was giving her the worst headache of her life, just when she was trying to think. What if she reached out somehow and connected to nature? Except that nature wasn't just one process. It was a whole host of processes that cascaded together in ways that nobody could predict. And if she remembered anything from her one and only conversation with that stupid tree, it was that she would be serving nature, not commanding nature. And she couldn't believe that she hadn't made that one crucial distinction clear in all her stupid conversations about her experience. And now it was too late, and they were going to die as colossal fuck-ups. She couldn't control nature. She couldn't even control herself. And this magnetic field was crushing her like a huge steely hand. She was being smushed by magnetism. A massive dog ran right at her, barking loud enough to be heard over the guns and chaos, and she was startled to realize she understood what it was saying. Mostly, "I'm going to bite your throat. You're dead." And this seemed a particularly pointless moment for her to regain the ability to understand animals, when there was no reasoning with them. And this just reminded her of the fact that she was powerless to shape or even influence the so-called forces of nature, and she really wished this magnetic flux wasn't giving her the worst migraine in the history of skulls. And then it hit her, and she knew what to do. She raised her hands to the skies and hoped for the best, before there was a blinding crack, and... Patricia woke up on board an airship. Not the same one they'd stolen. She lay on a bench, and Canote was staring down at her, with a look she could only describe as wrathful on his hairless albino face. "You've disappointed me," Canote said in a flat voice. Patricia wanted to say it was all Diantha's idea, but she couldn't make herself go there. "What happened?" "Toby's dead. So are half a dozen guards at that installation you decided to attack on your own initiative. I hope you can live with that. Diantha and Samir are injured, but they'll both live. It appears you somehow tapped into the increased magnetic field at the polar region and unleashed a kind of EMP that fried not only everything electronic for a dozen miles, but also everyone's brains, including your own. You should not have been able to do that. And we're not sure how you did." "There was a dog that wanted to bite me." Her head was pounding, and she kept seeing weird shapes. Then something occurred to her. Toby was wearing an El Tisley scarf, and we brought the airship. It had an insignia on the side.
Already dealt with. There won't be any traces to link back to the school.
Connaught let out a snort from deep in the pit of his stomach.
Your life is going to be very different from here on out.
I'm so sorry.
Not as sorry as you're going to be.
He looked like he was going to say something else, like maybe offer to let her off the hook in exchange for her firstborn. But instead he just shrugged and walked away, leaving Patricia with a throbbing head and a sense of wrongs that could never be set right. She raised her head enough to see out one of the big portholes. They flew over the ocean, and the sun was falling through clouds that were a heavy, ugly purple.
Chapter 23. The parrots were eating cherry blossoms on top of a big tree on the crest of a steep hill, not far from Grace Cathedral. A half-dozen bright green birds with red splotches on their heads, just tearing the shit out of these white flowers. Petals scattered across the sidewalk in the grass as the birds squawked and worked their crooked beaks, while Lawrence and Patricia watched from the steep bank of the parklet across the street. San Francisco never stopped astonishing Lawrence. Wild raccoons and possums wandered the streets, especially at night, and their shiny fur and long tails looked just like stray cats, unless you look twice. Skunks nested under people's houses. These parrots were native to somewhere in South America, where cherry trees never grew, but they developed a taste for cherry blossoms somehow.
Most of the people Lawrence knew spent every minute obsessing about what Computron Newsly was saying about them and their friends, or who was still getting funding in spite of the crunch.
The only reason Lawrence ever saw these urban twists of nature was because he hung out with Patricia. She saw a whole different city than he did. Truth was, Lawrence only half paid attention to the amazing sight of these bright tropical birds devouring flowers, because he kept trying to wrap his mind around the fact that he had nearly erased a human being from existence. Lawrence had barely slept in the past couple weeks, because he'd been spending 20 hours a day trying to figure out what had gone wrong. Plus, when he tried to sleep, his heart did a circus drum roll as he remembered Priya's mouth opening and closing. Even now, sitting with Patricia on a rough horse blanket on the grass, Lawrence kept bracing himself for her to say something. She knew full well what had happened to Priya, maybe even better than Lawrence did, and she hadn't said one judgmental word about it yet. She was probably just waiting for the right moment. Patricia broke the silence. "Okay," she said. "What's wrong?" Her pale knee had faint, grassy indentations. "Nothing," Lawrence put on a smile. "I'm watching the birds. They're awesome." "Jesus, now you have to tell me what's wrong. I've known you long enough to know when you're stewing." So Lawrence admitted, "I'm just waiting for you to tell me what an asshole I was, to do that experiment with Priya without any proper safeguards, so you had to save our asses. I figured you would want to let me have it." Patricia squirmed, as if he was putting her in an uncomfortable position. "I didn't really think that was my place," she said at last. "Don't you have bosses who will tell you off? I figured you guys were all doing a lot of soul-searching."
"Yeah, of course. Of course."
Actually, none of Lawrence's teammates had wanted to talk about the incident afterward. Once or twice, someone had mentioned Priya's accident, and this had triggered an awkward, protracted silence that made Lawrence feel like he'd swallowed an ice cube whole. Anya was still annoyed that Lawrence wouldn't explain how Patricia had rescued Priya, since they couldn't establish protocols without knowing what had worked last time. Saugata and Priya were trying to put this nightmare behind them. Meanwhile, Lawrence never quite found the right time to mention it to Isabel, who was technically supervising him.
"Lawrence, listen.
Patricia was looking at him instead of the birds. Her eyes opened wide, and she chewed her lower lip. It really meant a lot to me when you said that you weren't going to help tear me down, the way Kawashima asked you to. But you shouldn't build me up, either. Or it's going to drive me nuts. I've done things I will never be able to put behind me. You couldn't stand to be near me if you knew everything I've done. Lawrence had that hitting an air pocket on an airplane feeling, hearing Patricia talk this way. Like Patricia was about to open up to him. And that was exciting, for reasons he couldn't divulge to himself. But then he was terrified that she was right, and maybe there really were things that would give him no choice but to recoil from her. What if she was about to say that she recharged her witch powers by drinking the blood of babies? Plus, every single time he learned more about Patricia and magic, he lost something. None of this, though, overrode the adrenaline buzz of, "Holy fuck, I feel close to this person right now." In his skin, in his scalp even, in his chest. "Whatever," Lawrence said aloud. "You already helped clean up after my biggest fuck-up. I don't see how your shit can be worse than that." On the sidewalk downhill from where they sat, a woman with a stroller was yelling at her toddler, a lank-haired kid in overalls who kept running up to the cherry tree and trying to harass the parrots, who just laughed at him. The mother threatened to count to five. "When I was a teenager, some of us went off half-cocked and attacked this drilling project in Siberia, and people died, including my friend. And these days..." Patricia took a heavy breath, almost shaking. "I curse people. Like, one guy who had raped and killed a bunch of girls, I turned into a cloud. There was a lobbyist who helped to block environmental regulations. They called him the Picasso of the Paperwork Reduction Act, and I conned him into becoming a sea turtle. Sea turtles live a long time, longer than most humans, so it wasn't murder. These bureaucrats were trying to kick my friend Reginald out of Section 8 housing, and I gave one of them a rash, and so on." She couldn't look straight at Lawrence. "Wow." Lawrence shouldn't have been surprised, after what happened to Mr. Rose. But Patricia had said that was one of the senior witch's handiwork. For a moment, he felt like this steep hillside was tipping over, and then he got his center of gravity together again. "Wow," Lawrence said again. "I gotta admit, that's not what I pictured you doing. I kind of imagined you more, I don't know, going around and blessing babies or something."
"You're thinking of fairies. If I blessed a baby, it would have exactly the same effect as if you blessed a baby."
"I doubt that," Lawrence snorted. "Babies tend to projectile vomit at the sight of me. Anyway, it sounds like you put the smackdown on people who deserve it. I don't know. If I could turn people into turtles, there would be turtles everywhere."
Neither of them talked for a while. The mother had coaxed her kid back into the stroller and was speeding down toward the marina. The parrots had stopped munching and were just flying back and forth between the cherry tree and a couple other big trees, flanking a massive Edwardian townhouse, screaming in midair. Once or twice they flew right over Lawrence's head, green plumage extended like a salute.
"I guess I'm curious," Lawrence said. "Do you have an ethical framework? I mean, beyond that one rule they kept mentioning. How do you know what to do?"
He spoke carefully, because this was obviously kind of an intense conversation for Patricia. She was averting her gaze now.
Patricia said, raising her shoulders so her breasts lifted up inside her white T-shirt. "I mean, sometimes I'm following instructions from Kawashima or Ernesto, and I trust them. But also, I can't just turn everyone into turtles. I have to go with the situation. And see those parrots?" She gestured at the candy apple birds, which were back at their tasty cherry tree after making a few tours of the parklet.
"Yeah, of course.
Lawrence watched the red spots on their heads bopping around. They seemed to be taunting anybody who might want to cage them. I can understand what they're saying. Mostly they're pissed at their friend in the middle, who keeps almost getting eaten by hawks because he's too dumb to stay high up. And those crows over there, too. I can understand what they're all saying right now. Wow. Lawrence hadn't even noticed the crows on the power line nearby, watching them intently. So you can understand them all? All the time? It takes a certain amount of concentration, but yes. Can all the magic people do that, like Kawashima and Taylor? Maybe, if they really need to, if they make a big effort. Not most of the time. Different people have different weird quirks. And doesn't it drive you nuts to hear animals talking all the time? Not really. I guess I'm just used to it. Most of the time I tune it out, the same way you tune out all the people talking around you. But at the same time, I always have in the back of my mind the idea of, what would the crows think? Crows are really smart. The crows seem to be having some kind of intense political debate, cawing and filibustering. One of them shook its wings, almost like a wet dog. Lawrence knew he was about to screw everything up. He should just keep his mouth shut. But then Patricia would know he was keeping an opinion to himself, and that could be worse. "Please don't take this the wrong way," he said. "But I don't think that's a basis for an ethical framework. What would the crows think? The crows can't fully grasp the ramifications of the kind of choices you're talking about. A crow couldn't understand how a nuclear reactor works, or what the Paperwork Reduction Act is. Do you know what the Paperwork Reduction Act is?" Lawrence was burning up inside his too-tight collar. I mean, it's a law, right? And I'm guessing it reduces paperwork.
Jesus, do you even listen to yourself?
Yes, I know that crows can't understand nuclear physics, not unlike most people. I'm not saying that I ask the crows for scientific advice. Lawrence finally risked looking up, and Patricia was more laughing than upset, with a bit of eye-rolling in the mix, too. He could live with that.
"Yeah," he said. "I'm just saying that some ethical questions are more complex."
"Sure. Yeah."
Patricia shook her head and sort of whistled. "But you're colossally missing the point, almost like on purpose. I'm saying that there are a lot of different ways of looking at the world, and maybe I actually do have a unique advantage because I get to hear different voices. You really don't get that?" Lawrence felt like maybe the crows were laughing at him now, as if Patricia had tipped them off somehow.
"I get that. I do. I think ethics are universal and derived from principles, and I think that situational ethics are a slippery slope. Plus, I don't think crows have much, if any, notion of ethics. I don't think a crow has ever even considered the categorical imperative."
"I love that this conversation started out with you worrying that I was judging you, and ended up with you judging me." Patricia had definitely stiffened a little and gotten a little farther away on the blanket. Lawrence was feeling kind of toxic, and also worrying that he'd gone and pissed off the one person he could actually talk to in this stupid world.
"I'm not judging you. I'm not. You have to know that. I already said if it were me, there would be turtles everywhere."
"I don't actually think that ethics are derived from principles. At all." Patricia scooted a little closer again and touched his arm with a few cool fingertips where she'd gripped it earlier. "I think that the most basic thing of ethics is being aware of how your actions affect others and having an awareness of what they want and how they feel. And that's always going to depend on who you're dealing with." Lawrence took a deep breath and realized that he and Patricia were having a disagreement, and this wasn't the end of the world. Like, it wasn't ideal that she'd opened up to him about this area that she was incredibly sensitive about, and he'd immediately started shooting down her ideas. But she could take it, and she could give as good as she got. Actually, I get what you're saying. I was kind of thinking the same thing recently, Lawrence said. He told her about how he imagined going to another planet, and seeing firsthand that none of the things we took for granted on Earth were true here, that there was no such thing as the way things were supposed to be. And maybe that's what you have right here on Earth, a non-human perspective on reality. So, yeah, I do get it. Cool, she said. She rooted in her bag until she found her caddy, which was letting her know that she had someplace else to be. Lawrence wanted to say something else, like that the fact that Patricia worried so much about being a monster probably meant she wouldn't ever be one. But she was already tromping down the hill, pausing only for a second to say something, advice, or maybe just props, to the parrots, which showered her with white fluff, like rice at a wedding. All the upscale, organic, micro-restaurants in Soma had gone under, so Lawrence and Serafina ended up eating at a greasy diner selling Chinese food and donuts. The donuts were fresh, but the General Tso's chicken was a little too general. Lawrence felt embarrassed that he wasn't showing Serafina a better time. Serafina didn't seem to mind, though. She even ate a donut with chopsticks. Her false eyelashes almost reached her cheeks, and he couldn't bear to look at her. She was amazing. He would have given almost anything to trigger the nuclear option. He could give her some other ring, sure, but it wouldn't have the same significance without the story about his grandmother. Serafina had finished her donut and was studying her phone. The neon donuts sign crackled. Lawrence realized that neither of them had talked for ages. I wish I could use active listening to fill the silence. He couldn't stop picturing Priya's dazzled expression, and it gave him a sour taste in his mouth and a large bolus in his stomach. Okay, what's up with you? Serafina said. Nothing, Lawrence said. He couldn't tell Serafina about Priya, not without getting into the truth about the anti-gravity experiment. Plus, Serafina would demand to know how exactly they'd saved Priya. We had a setback at work, and I have no idea what to tell Isabel, let alone Milton.
Tell them the truth, I guess. They're grown-ups, right?
She shrugged, then looked back at her phone. Lawrence and Serafina were supposed to spend the night together, but Lawrence ended up going back to work to pull another all-nighter instead.
Maybe if I go without sleeping another few days, he told Serafina, I'll be able to report some progress instead of that failure.
Or maybe you'll just get sleep-deprived and make even bigger mistakes,
Serafina said, smiling, because she'd been there herself.
Good luck. Love you.
She walked back up toward Market, where the BART was having irregular service, and Lawrence watched her the whole way back up the block, wondering if she would look back at him over her shoulder or turn to wave one last time. She didn't. His heart skidded like a dirt bike on black ice as he watched her disappear. Lawrence wanted to wait until Isabel was in a good mood to tell her about Priya's accident, but after several days, Lawrence realized Isabel was never in a good mood lately. Almost the first thing she'd ever said to Lawrence was that she hated to be an authority figure, and now she was Milton's second-in-command in this huge venture, laying down the law for a small army of geeks. Whenever Isabel saw herself in the mirror, wearing a plum-colored business suit with her hair in a gray bob, she did a double-take. At last, after Lawrence had pulled two all-nighters in a row at the lab, he decided to bite the bullet. When he crawled home, Isabel was staring at satellite images of the Atlantic Ocean at the small kitchen table, and she pointed at an ugly smudge in the Gulf Stream.
Superstorm Camilla.
Oh, yeah. Lawrence peered over her shoulder. I heard about that. A near miss on the East Coast. Everybody said it could have been way worse than Sandy or Becky.
Third near miss in the past couple years, Isabel said, and hurricane season isn't over yet. Milton is wigging out.
Lawrence pulled up a chair. Listen, I don't want you to tell Milton, but we had a setback at work.
What kind of setback?
Isabel pushed her laptop shut with a click. We had an accident. At the lab. Lawrence tried to explain the whole story without mentioning Patricia at all. We're all pretty unsure how to move forward.
Well,
Isabel pushed her chair back and went to get a bottle of grappa from the cabinet, pouring some for Lawrence and some for herself. She sat back down with her elbows on the table.
Sounds like you need more safety protocols, and maybe don't randomly test your equipment on human subjects without talking to Milton or myself first.
Yeah, Lawrence swallowed. That was dumb, and that's on me. But I feel like the way the anti-gravity field destabilized makes me nervous. That just shouldn't have happened. We've done some tests, but we have to do a lot more. But I'm thinking we may have to go back to square one and try a completely different approach.
Uh-huh.
Isabel sipped and narrowed her eyes at him.
The last time we spoke, you said it was looking really good.
Lawrence felt the sleepless days catching up with him. It was. It was looking really good. Until it wasn't.
You just asked me not to tell Milton, which means you want me to lie to him and say you're actually accomplishing your part of the project, without which all the other team's work is a waste of time.
You want me to tell him what? That you're really close to a breakthrough when you've actually gone back to square one? She tossed back some grappa and poured more for Lawrence.
Hey,
Lawrence leaned backward on the rear legs of his chair until he was in serious danger of crashing on his back. Nobody's lying to Milton. He knows we're doing everything we can. You guys trusted me with this.
Isabel was shaking her head. I can't do this. You can tell Milton what you just told me. He's coming to town in a few days. Tell him you're stuck, and he'll send you to the facility he's set up outside Denver, where you will have zero distractions.
Lawrence had a sudden flashback of his parents hauling him to a death trap of a military school, and his sleepless haze was turning red.
Just please listen to what I'm telling you, he said, planting the chair on all four legs and gripping the table with both fists.
We're not giving up, goddammit. We're just taking a fucking step back. Don't try to blackmail me or pressurize me here. The fuck?
It's not blackmail,
Isabel said, pouring herself more grappa.
It's what will absolutely happen. You signed a contract. You committed to this project, and you've gotten the kid gloves treatment because you're my friend. Do you remember when you came to stay with me 6 years ago?
Yes, Lawrence said. His parents had been divorcing, and he'd needed a place to hide. He'd only just reconnected with Isabel, and she'd invited him to live in her crawl space for the summer while she pulled the plug on her aerospace startup. When Lawrence thought back to that summer now, his main impression was of the desert's heat, smacking you in the face the moment you stepped out of an air-conditioned space. Lawrence had toted an iPad as he'd shadowed Isabel, trying to make whatever she needed materialize without her even asking. A girl named Ivy, with long black hair and cherry lip gloss, had made out with Lawrence behind the ozone-scented silos late at night. Milton hung around wearing a golf hat and shorts. Lawrence had been startled to realize that Milton was that old guy in the turtleneck who'd yelled at him for touching the rocket at MIT. Milton had kept saying things like, "Making the leap from a planetary infestation to an interplanetary diaspora is the most important task the human race has ever attempted. It is quite literally do or die." Isabel hissed a little as the grappa hit her throat.
"You followed me like a puppy, while I was desperately trying to hold it together. We all thought you were just a starstruck kid, but then on the last day you brought us that physics paper, when we were all sitting on that sofa with the broken leg, watching Nine Inch Nails videos and crying."
"The paper about gravity tunneling," Lawrence said. "I remember.
Some insane physicist from Wollongong had speculated about a method of interstellar travel. Milton had started to dismiss it, but then he'd read the paper a second time and started scribbling notes on his arm. And that had helped lead to Milton founding the 10% Project, with the idea of getting 10% of the population off-world within a few decades. So don't sit there and try to pretend that you're just an innocent bystander," Isabel said. "You helped start this, and maybe you haven't been paying attention to the news. The world is on the edge of the cliff here."
"I'm aware." Lawrence shifted backward and forward.